Welcome into another episode of the Half Court Press Podcast. I'm John Niatawa. He's Chris Hetty, here to break down the recent happenings in Nebraska and Creighton hoops.
There's been a lot.
So close to having two teams, being able to talk about two teams that picked up top 10 road wins.
Mm-hmm.
Creighton got it done late against Seton Hall, and Nebraska made a ferocious comeback.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like,
weird.
Put everything into it and nearly got over the hump at the end. Just had the potential game winner, Cam Mack's layup shot. It was blocked.
Maryland did literally everything they possibly could to lose that game.
You think so? But Nebraska, in a way, did a lot of things.
They did, yeah. But like Maryland missed like the front end of 2 1-and-1s and like turned the ball over in the backcourt. Right. We can get into that later. But yeah, we were very close. I thought you were gonna say to just talking about two teams who won in the same week.
Oh.
But you're right. Almost. I mean, two top 10 teams. I mean, took two top 10 teams to the brink and won one and one didn't.
Yeah. So we'll start with the team that won. Creighton obviously took down Seton Hall 87-82. It was kind of another one of those installments of Creighton small ball versus the opposing, like, more traditional lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Seton Hall is actually probably bigger at the four and the five than most teams. Sandro Mamukashvili is 6'11", and Romario Gill is 7'2", and he's the Big East leading shot blocker. So those guys can be somewhat of an intimidating presence on the interior on both ends of the floor. And then they bring another guy off the bench, Obiagu, who's 7 foot. So Seton Hall really has the ability to control the paint, whereas Creighton was going to counter that with speed and quickness. And I thought did a great job of using sort of the standard advantages that you'd think you'd have with five guards on the floor at the same time,
mm-hmm.
which Creighton did,
mm-hmm.
Had to go to because of foul trouble. I thought the Jays did a good job of like being quicker to the ball, playing with a little bit more desire and hustle than Seton Hall. Like the want to was there. And that's kind of been part of Creighton's MO all year, but to do it on the opposing floor of the Big East leader, I thought said a lot. And so the Jays made a ton of hustle plays. They pushed tempo in the first half when they had to go small, super small, with five guards on the floor. They had, I think there were 15 possessions that Creighton had offensively with those five guards, and their average length of possession was just under 12 seconds. They were really pushing tempo, and Tyshawn Alexander hit three threes in sort of the fast break / secondary break situations, mm-hmm. where Seton Hall just couldn't quite get matched up. Creighton got a couple layups, and then the Jays in the second half, I thought, were really clever when Seton Hall pressed out to try to take away the 3-point line. I thought Creighton did a good job of making Seton Hall pay. You know, they'd space him out and then back cuts to the rim, maybe slip a screen. Christian Bishop had a play where he faked a dribble handoff and turned and drove to the rim for a dunk. And then once the Jays went super small again, I thought they did a good job of sort of attacking mismatches. Damian Jefferson was everywhere, cleaning up on the glass and cutting to the rim, beating his man. Denzel Mahoney went one-on-one in isolation situations, and also Denzel hit two big threes. He hit one in transition to give Creighton the lead for good, 69-66, with about 6 minutes left. And then with, I think it was like a minute left in the game, Seton Hall pulled within one and had some momentum. There was a breakdown by the Pirates. They were in matchup zone, I think, but lost Denzel, and he stepped up and hit a three-point shot to put Creighton up for it, and then the Jays sealed it with free throws late. So it was an impressive win for Creighton. Obviously, if they want to stay in contention in the Big East title race, which they do, they had to win at Seton Hall to keep the Pirates from building too much of a lead. Or cushion.
So they still have like a 2-game lead, is that right?
Yeah, Seton Hall is a 2-game lead over Creighton, and Villanova won on Wednesday as well. So there's two teams tied for second. The Jays do get 4 of their final 6 games at home, and they get Seton Hall again. So we'll see if the Pirates stumble. Like, obviously, Creighton needs help. They're 2 games back. They still need Seton Hall to lose again. But and Creighton has to avoid any mishaps or hiccups, which is going to be tough, obviously, in this league. But the Jays have a chance, and so I think that was one of the goals for them going into that game. And then the other takeaway is just, I mean, I think we talked about this a month ago of like how much better can Creighton get, or what's the sort of ceiling for this group, especially given its limitations. They have a 6'7 center and a 6'11 center off the bench. That's like their only two big men. And you could argue that Christian Bishop's not even a traditional big man. Mm-hmm. So without that size, like, what is, you know, how can Creighton overcome its flaws? And I thought the game on Wednesday was sort of the peak example of what, I guess, just how potent Creighton can be with the pieces that it has. Marcus Zagorowski creating the way he does. Tyshawn Alexander, didn't even mention his defense against Miles Powell. He locked up one of the best scorers in college basketball. Powell was 3 of 16 from the floor, and Tyshawn did a good job. No, granted, Creighton did a good job too of sort of, it was a team defense. They had help for Tyshawn Alexander in certain spots, and Marcus Zagorowski got a piece of Powell, and Damian Jefferson had to guard him at times, but Tyshawn was the primary defender in most situations, and he made it uncomfortable for Powell to find a rhythm. And so I just feel like Creighton's found a nice piece or a nice flow with the groups, or with the group of guys that it has. It's only a 7-man rotation now with Sharif Mitchell out with injury, but we saw what, when things are clicking, what it could look like against Seton Hall, which the Pirates are one of the best defensive teams in the country, and Creighton scored 87 points on them.
But explain to me how they score 87 points and Mitch Ballack has zero.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you get a top 10 win on the road and Mitch Ballack doesn't even score. Like, that's impressive. That's got to give you a ton of confidence going into, you know, the tournament or going into this final stretch, because that shows you that you have people off the bench. Denzel Mahoney can score 18. Damian Jefferson can score 18. Like, you, if somebody isn't on, you have some people that can fill in. You know what I mean? Like, that goes so far. And I think it shows how good the team actually is. I mean, they only played 7 guys and one of them didn't score, and he's probably their best shooter and scorer. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is.
I think one of the comments that Coach McDermott made after the game was like, he's almost like, he's just like, I don't think it was frustration, but it's kind of like, well, if you're going to guard Mitch Ballack like that, then the other people are going to make you pay.
Yeah.
So Seton Hall was just basically glued to him.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't let him get any looks. I thought Seton Hall's defenders were pretty physical with Mitch too. Like, they were hugging him a little bit on screens, and you know, when he caught it, they were kind of reaching at the ball. There were a few deflections. Now, he did break free for some open mid-range jumpers, and there was a 3 late in transition where he ball faked and a defender kind of moved, went for that fake, and Mitch was wide open for a 3, and mm-hmm. It's like, that's a shot that normally goes down, but he was still 0-for-7 from the floor, and like you said, he didn't score, so you're like, how does the offense still keep humming without him sort of putting the ball in the basket? But his presence made mm-hmm. the impact.
Sure, yeah.
You have to, you're so conscious of where he is on the floor that it opens up space for other guys to roam. And when you take a defender out of the lane, remember there's a lot of these plays in the second half when Seton Hall was really pressed up on shooters. Like, Tyshawn Alexander would be on one side of the floor, Mitch Ballack would be on the other side, and both defenders would be, you know, within arm's length of him. You're mm-hmm. touching him basically, which left the paint wide open. All of a sudden, you got Marcus Zagorowski setting a ball screen or kind of maneuvering around up at the top of the key with a big man stepping out, and the opposing big man has to guard that. You know, he has to be up there. He can't be sagged off into the paint. He's got to take away that 3-point shot from Marcus Zagorowski. So the Jays, I mean, Zagorowski back cut when he sort of like faked that he was going for a dribble handoff and then back cut to the rim for a layup.
Mm-hmm.
He beat his man for a layup. They found Christian Bishop diving to the rim on one. I mean, I just thought the Jays were really good at making Seton Hall pay for that sort of strategy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of teams do this, by the way, and sometimes it has worked where they've really stretched out and taken away that 3-point shot. But Seton Hall, especially in the second half, was committed to that, and the Jays were really good at countering it.
I also think it's important to note, you know, you've put a bunch of videos on Twitter about it, but, you know, Miles Powell goes 1 of 11 from 3, and he goes 2 of 5 from 2. He has 2 assists and 4 turnovers.
Yeah.
I mean, Tyshawn really, I mean, there was one play you had, you post, I mean, he was right up on the ball, right when it should be, he's fighting through screens. Like, I think that for him to do score 18 and be as efficient as he was from three, he's 4 of 8, and then also be able to guard Miles Powell, and yeah. he played how many minutes? He played 37. I mean, that's impressive. Like, that's something that goes a long way.
Yeah, it's like, on one side, it's impressive what Tyshawn was able to do defensively, but then the other side, as you mentioned, like, to be efficient as a scorer on offense when you're exerting so much effort defensively, mm-hmm. and then still, you know, you're one of the go-to guys on offense and taking big-time shots. And
because that doesn't happen very often. A lot of times you'll see, like, you know, if a Big Ten team's going up against Cassius Winston and, you know, their best, you know, guard is going to have to guard him, then the teams will, coaches will say, like, we're okay if you don't have it, you know, offensively, but you need to shut down right. Cassius Winston. But to be able to do both, that's super important.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd still say the Marquette game when Tyshawn, it's funny because, like, he didn't shut down Powell, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
He limited him.
Yeah.
And he made him comfortable. He didn't shut him down. Powell also missed some good looks.
Sure.
At various points, and Tyshawn didn't shut down Marcus Howard in the first Marquette game at the start of the year when Howard finished with 18, but he made him uncomfortable,
right?
And he did,
made it a little bit harder,
and he did probably, I mean, when you look at the stats, like, he did a better job than most mm-hmm. against probably almost everyone against Marcus Howard. Miles Powell is one game in Big East play where he scored less than 10 points. Against Xavier, I think he had 9. I think Najee Marshall drew that assignment for the most part and did a good job against Powell. So Tyshawn Alexander's effort, I mean, Powell had 9 points until there was like a second left. He banged in a 3 late. Mm-hmm. That was his first 3. Yeah. So you mentioned like 1 of 11 from 3, yeah. but he was 0 of 10 until 5 seconds left.
So real quick, though. So you've got Kyrie and you've got Tyshawn, two guys that might be able to make some money off playing defense.
Yeah, Kyrie's making money.
Right,
yeah.
right.
I don't. Yeah,
what is that? Is that Mac? Is that the system? Like, what is the common thread between those two? Is it just the guys themselves? Because that's
right.
What is
yeah.
that?
Well, part of it is sort of a need. Mm-hmm. Like Creighton, with the way that its roster has been formed under Coach McDermott in the Big East, like, it has to have good perimeter defenders, because on the back end of the yeah. defense, there hasn't been. Aside from Justin Patton, when he was there at the rim blocking shots, the Jays haven't had a consistent rim protector mm-hmm. since they've been in the Big East. So they've needed perimeter defenders to stop the ball, to slow down an opposing team's best scorer, best creator, best dribbler. And so I think that's part of it, because the coaches are like, look, we need somebody.
Yeah.
So who's gonna step into this role? Kyrie was wired in a way that that's what he wanted to do regardless. It didn't matter if he played for Creighton or
right.
Kansas State.
Right.
He was going to be a lockdown defender in his mind. That was sort of his that was always sort of his ticket to the next level. You know, when he was in middle school, that's how he's going to get on the floor as a high schooler, and how he's going to get attention from college coaches and play at the next level in college. And then obviously in the NBA, got drafted because of his defense. I'm curious to see what the buzz is for Tyshawn from an NBA perspective at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. Because
he's a junior, correct?
Yeah, he's a junior. And there hasn't been a ton. You know, I look at those mock drafts, and I've seen his name pop up a little bit as a potential second-round guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he – the thing about Kyrie is he had the NBA body. He was thick, 6'5", with a 6'11 wingspan, and he made threes at a consistent rate. So he fit the mold of, like, oh, he's a two guard who can guard 1 through 4.
Mm-hmm.
Tyshawn Alexander is a little bit shorter, not as long of a wingspan, so he maybe doesn't have the potential to stretch out to guard a 4. Maybe he's good at defending a 1, 2, or 3, but there's still a place for a player like that in the league, especially given his scoring prowess.
Mm-hmm.
So I am curious to see now that, because he's made tons of improvements. He didn't come to Creighton as a defender. He, like, kind of like I said about Creighton needing somebody to step up, he saw that as an opportunity. He's told us a few times this year that, like, you know, if I want to play at the next level, I know that I can't just be a scorer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I remember he said something specific about, like, there's tons of guys in the NBA who, you know, maybe yeah, everyone wants to be the go-to guy, the Damian Lillard, the Steph Curry, the James Harden, who has the ball in their hands and's, you know, making tons of money, obviously, and is the superstar. But he's like, look at how many guys are in the league that are just playing their role and making a ton of money doing that and having a blast playing ball. He's like, I don't mind if that's who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think...
Which you don't get a lot. That's right. Mature perspective. Right. A lot he's of guys like, think like, well, no matter what, I can be that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's like, I want to do everything I can to help my team. And then hopefully NBA scouts will look at it and say, okay, maybe he can do that same thing at the next level. And that's what, and he's comfortable having that role. So I think he kind of bought into that, knowing that he can't just be a one dimensional player. He had to do more things and impact the game in other ways. So Tyshawn's really elevated his game. And I think, I mean, I think he is in contention to be named Big East Defensive Player of the Year. We'll see how it shakes out. He's still got another matchup against Marcus Howard, and he's got another one against Miles Powell. Mm-hmm. Both of those players are going to be like licking their chops a little bit to say, we need to prove something against you.
Right.
But what he's done during Big East play, Tyshawn, against some really good perimeter scorers has been incredibly impressive. And so, yeah, Creighton's an offensive-oriented program. They're about pushing tempo and letting it fly.
Yeah.
They bring guys, they recruit to that. And then they get here, and then Creighton's like, well, you know, we can't – the coaches are like we can't outscore everybody. We got to defend. And it took Tyshawn and Mitch Balick and Marcus Zagorowski some time to sort of buy into that principle of, hey, got to bring that same sort of energy defensively. But they bought into it now.
Yeah.
And for Tyshawn, it's really elevated his game to another level.
Do you want to talk Big East race real quick?
Yeah, we'll mention it.
So this is interesting to me. So you look at Creighton's remaining schedule, and it lines up pretty nice. KenPom has them losing once. So it's DePaul, Marquette, Butler, St. John's, Georgetown, and Seton Hall. And then you look at Seton Hall's final schedule, and it's pretty tough.
It is tough.
They've got Providence, and then Butler, St. John's, and then you end with Marquette, Villanova, and Creighton. And that final Creighton game is in Omaha.
Right. And the Marquette game's on the road.
Do you think that Creighton final game at home is for a share of the Big East title?
Right. It could be. Pull up Villanova's schedule real quick, because I'm kind of curious. And KenPom has Seton Hall going 4-2 down the stretch.
Yes, correct.
So in KenPom's world right now, Seton Hall
wins
the conference by a game.
Villanova, they play Temple.
It doesn't count. Yeah, just out of conference
for whatever reason. Well, why the heck are they playing Temple on February 16th?
Villanova, part of Philly's like Big Five thing. Okay. You know, they always play each other. So I'm not quite sure why it got pushed all the way to.
That seems like a December 21st game. Like, what are you doing? So they get DePaul, Xavier, St. John's, Providence, Seton Hall, Georgetown. That's not bad.
It's a pretty good one.
If Nova plays the way that they could play,
but KenPom has them losing three games.
Yeah, but they tried really hard to lose that game last night. Yeah, they tried really hard.
Blew an 18-point lead or something.
Yeah, and they were up. I was watching. They were up like 8 with 2 minutes left, and Marcus Howard had the ball. They were down 3. With like 5 seconds left, and he tried to like throw it off the backboard to like hit the rim and get it, whatever, and kind of screwed it up. But
that's interesting. Yeah,
those
Villanova
three,
kind of feels like it's not quite playing great. I mean, lost 3 in a row, obviously, and then had to find a way to hang on late against Marquette. So maybe Villanova finds another gear.
Maybe.
But
it does kind of seem like a two horse race.
KenPom says it's a two horse race.
Yeah.
So Creighton's going to need Seton Hall to lose at another time, obviously, than just...
So they need to beat Seton Hall at the very end of the year, and then they need them to lose to either Marquette or Villanova.
Yeah.
That's pretty good odds, in my opinion.
There's definitely a chance that happens.
Yeah.
But that's also assuming that Creighton also doesn't lose.
True.
So Creighton can't
that
lose.
That is true. Creighton cannot lose. Creighton has to win out, and Seton Hall needs to lose once before the Creighton game.
Before the Creighton-Seton Hall rematch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's possible that Creighton will lose to Marquette, but Seton Hall will also lose to Marquette.
Mm-hmm.
And then
what do we have?
Then the question is whether or not Seton Hall loses at Providence or loses to Villanova at home.
Mm.
Both of those games were losses for Creighton. Creighton lost to Providence, lost to Villanova at home.
Mm-hmm.
So Creighton needs one of those to go the same way that it went for itself.
Yeah. But so, again, what were they projected? Fourth?
Creighton?
Yeah.
At the start of the year?
Yeah.
The coaches picked them seventh.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah,
they're going to do better than that.
They are. I picked them fourth. I picked Creighton fourth.
Yeah.
I think I had it Villanova, Seton Hall, Xavier, Creighton.
Yeah.
It's a surprise to see Creighton. If you would have told me that they had a chance to win the Big East, I would have said, I'm not expecting that. Because it felt like Seton Hall and Nova had just a little bit of cut above everybody else going into the year. But they've done a really good job, as I said off the top, of just maximizing who they are.
And this
and
might
playing
just
to what they do well.
And this might just be me, but as important as it is to win your conference, and obviously it'd be a big deal, it'd be really cool, all these things, I still think it'd be a much bigger deal if you don't win the conference, you don't win the conference tournament, if they go to the Sweet 16, then that's way more important.
No doubt.
That's what you remember. And so that's the thing
I think
you have to also
keep in mind. Harder to win the regular season championship in a power conference league.
I agree.
Than get to the Sweet 16.
Yeah.
But apparently,
I almost like, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
I think you should get a lot of praise for that.
Yes.
But in college basketball, it doesn't work like that.
Well, it's weird. Like, if you win the regular season, it almost doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter at all.
All it means is like, hey, you got the one seed. Because you think about this. Like, so think about this. I can't off the top of my head tell you where Iowa State finished when Fred Hoiberg was at Iowa State in the regular season. But I can tell you that they won two tournaments.
Yes.
And that's what people remember.
March.
Yes. Yeah. That's the only thing that matters. Not the only thing, but it really matters.
Yeah, that's what matters. Because Kansas won all those regular season titles, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Like, duh. That's, yeah. I don't think they shared it with Iowa State once. I think maybe they shared it with Baylor once or something.
Right.
That's a very good point.
But,
yeah.
And I think it, when you're playing against your peers who know you very well and you're able to perform on a consistent basis for 2 months, I think that, especially in the Big East where everyone plays the same schedule.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty good barometer of what kind of team you are. But again, this Creighton program, which, you know, I think over the last 20 years has made more NCAA tournaments. How do I phrase it? They've made the most NCAA tournaments without a Sweet 16 berth in the country.
Yeah.
Nobody else has been to the tournament more without going to the Sweet 16. The Jays haven't been to the Sweet 16 since the NCAA tournament reformatted itself in the 80s or whatever it was. So it's kind of like the elephant in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Every time you talk about where Creighton is as a program and what needs to be accomplished is, can they get to a Sweet 16? It's honestly quite remarkable that the Jays, over the last 20 years, given how often they were in the tournament, didn't.
Well, it's also, to the same but different extent, it's also remarkable that Nebraska is the only Power 6 school, I guess, that's never won
a tournament game.
Especially considering like they were a three seed a couple times.
Yeah.
Like it's a weird,
we
like
talked
at a certain
about
point
this last
you
year would, about like this weird, like, I don't know what it is. We said it like there was some sort of curse.
There was something that happened. Yeah, there
because
was definitely something
we
that
we talked
happened.
About it last year because Nebraska tanked, had a good team, looked like it had an opportunity to win a game, win an NCAA tournament game, tanked. Creighton, obviously, the last few years in the NCAA tournament has been in position to make a run and hasn't. UNO has been like on the brink of making the NCAA tournament and lost in title games. There's something weird. We got to break this cycle.
I know. It's got to break at
some point.
Half Court
Press podcast can do to like end it. Probably nothing, but maybe just acknowledging.
Maybe it's acknowledging that it's a curse.
That there's weird stuff going on.
We'll make
on.
It go away. Yeah.
And so we can feel the vibes. Let's switch to Nebraska.
Okay.
The Huskers came up, like we said at the top, that they came up just short at Maryland. A valiant effort by Nebraska. And I think we've seen this team play well at other points in the year, across the year before. It's been a while. But to me, I think it's like a blueprint of what, or maybe a sort of example of what Nebraska will look like in the future.
Mm-hmm.
next year, 2 years down the road? A little bit more size, obviously, but yeah, like that type of fight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
The pace that, I mean, Nebraska got Maryland in transition a few times, mm-hmm. and you know that's like top of mind. It should be for the Terrapins going into that game. So just like the way they share the ball, work together, never, you know, saw like some of those. I was watching the bench a lot mm-hmm. for Nebraska, mm-hmm. and the way that they were cheering each other on. Like I saw Cam Mack going crazy on the bench. Mm-hmm. I think maybe Hanif, when he went wild for that sort of stretch, like the bench is going nuts. I just thought that, you know, it was 40 minutes, so you got to put it into context with the rest of the season, obviously. Yeah. But for that 40
minutes.
But it's
still, yeah. I mean, this is a game that, like, someone very smartly pointed out, I picked them to lose by 30. I didn't think they had even a kind of a chance.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of different things happen at once. I think Maryland decided in the second half, like, we got this. This is fine. These guys aren't very good. And we're just going to kind of snooze. So you kind of get that.
Yeah.
I think Hanif Cheatham had something different going. I mean, he scored 20. He only played 26 minutes. He played through a calf contusion, which is not easy,
yeah.
because that you use your calf literally every time you do anything in basketball, which is why I didn't think he'd play, because like that's so hard to come from. But I think they benefited from a really late tip. They got there the day before, so he got treatment all day. And Fred Hoiberg said it was a game-time decision. And boy, it was a good decision, too. He played extremely well. What was interesting was, I think it also showed kind of what you get with Fred Hoiberg as your coach, because I think the initial game plan was take every open three you find. Take every open shot you get, because we don't really want to mess around in the lane. We don't really want to mess around with these guys. Let's shoot it as fast as humanly possible. Get your first open look. And Nebraska did that, and they started 1-for-10 from three.
Yeah.
And they kind of fell behind, and Maryland kind of, you know, was off. Like, they didn't look very good. Unbelievably disappointing crowd. I mean, there was nobody there. So they didn't really have energy there, and Nebraska made some shots, and they were able to kind of keep it interesting. But that second half, I think that Fred Hoiberg has preached on it so much about how disappointed he's been in the last couple games of Nebraska's first 5-6 minutes in the second half, that they turned it on to an extent where they were like, let's finally break this curve. Let's just break this. Let's just actually start playing well. They came out, they made 7 of the first 9 shots. In the first couple minutes of that second half, they abandoned the, let's take the first open three we find. And they got into the lane and they found this. I think Nebraska has done an extremely good job in the last couple games of like basically working the baseline and putting two guys in the short corner and driving and dishing and actually scoring inside. Yeah. They've actually made their layups for once, which it's, you know,
which is tough to do against Maryland.
Tough to do against one against Maryland. Yeah. Yeah. Nebraska, I think that they're no longer last, I don't think, in shots blocked. Let's see. They are 350th. So there's a couple teams worse, but they were scoring inside and
pump fakes, guys, come on.
Yeah, well, when you're small,
yeah, no, it's only so much you can do,
right? And so what's so interesting to me is like this box score makes no sense in a way where, okay, they win 72-70, but they shot 21% from three. That's not what you want from a Fred Hoiberg team.
Yeah,
and Cam Mack only scores 4 points. He goes 1-for-10. And so it's like, well, how did this happen? I think they defended really well. I think, again, Maryland was, for whatever reason, just hit the snooze button. Some of the quotes after the game from Mark Turgeon were they did a number on Mark Turgeon. Like, it was like, holy cow, man. But I think what this, you know, again, I don't think you want to make too much of any one single game. But I think the one thing that I've been getting a lot this year in emails and on Twitter and even from just friends is like, Nebraska needs a big man. They need a big man. They need a 6'11". You can't win without a big man in the Big Ten. And one of the reasons why I thought this game was going to be a 30-point, you know, whatever, is Maryland in some ways right now is what is exactly what you want as a Big Ten team, right? You have a senior guard and Anthony Callen who does exactly what you want him to do. You've got some size, you've got some shooters, you've got Jalen Smith, who's, you know, you always kind of want, that's, I think that's kind of the Big Ten prototype, where you have like a Miles Bridges or a Cody Zeller or a Jalen Smith, where you have this big guy, this 4 and 5 that can really dominate a game.
Yeah. versatile enough to where he's not just your true sort of like plotting five.
Right, right.
But
not, but and even like to your
move
point,
a little bit.
To your point, and, even yeah. like John Teske, right? John Teske can move it outside and all these things. Yeah. And so I think a lot of the thing that you get against Nebraska that people want is like, well, you need to have a five. Well, Kevin Cross was Nebraska's five, and he's maybe 6'7", and they only lost by two, right? And now Kevin didn't have a great game, but what he did do, I mean, there were times where it was just straight up five out. Straight up five out. Let's not even mess with the lane. And I don't view that as like a kind of fluky junk offense that you just do once or twice. Like, I think Nebraska will have some size next year with Derek Walker, and but he's not like the Jalen Smith, Cody Zeller, Miles Bridges. And you have Delano Banton, who, again, is not any of those guys either. Like, I think that what this game taught me is there is a possibility that this system actually will work in a Big Ten when you are always going to be the smallest team, mm-hmm. you know? Because I think that, and like, again, we also have to remember, most of Hoiberg's offense still isn't even in. Like, they still run like a lot of similar stuff, and you know, there's things that you are able to do with people who are currently not playing that you just cannot do with these guys.
You know what was interesting was when we did that story about Creighton and Nebraska mm-hmm. pushing tempo and playing some really innovative offense. One of the things that McDermott said about Hoiberg was that what he could tell was that the plays it was like, it's almost like they were at Hoiberg 101 and they hadn't elevated to 201 or 301 yet because they didn't have all the counters to mm-hmm. the plays. Mm-hmm. That, like, some of the set plays are in, but then what Hoiberg is so good at is like, oh, you think something's coming, then all of a sudden, bam, he hits you with a counter.
Yeah.
He's got multiple counters to different looks, and like that piece wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously with more time and off season to actually like sit down and work with these guys,
right.
like it's going to look different.
And I also
more efficient.
The other thing I want to bring up too is like, so this, they're coming off of the Penn State loss, which they didn't look good in Iowa, which they looked as bad as they have ever looked. And I was thinking about this, you know, the last time Nebraska lost this many in a row to end a season was 2014-15. So that was the year after the NCAA tournament bid. And that season, they lost 9 in a row. And they were competitive in some of those games, but it just didn't look like they really wanted to be there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there were just times where it was like, this is... And I've heard talk, you know, from people of like, well, has Hoiberg lost the locker room? Like, are these, you know, X, Y, and Z? Like, is this going to work kind of a thing? And I think that game, like, you don't go out and play that hard against the number 9 team in the country on the road if you're not playing for your coach and if you don't believe what's going to work, especially when you start 1-for-10 from three and you start so poorly and you walk onto the floor and you're like, I have to share this court with this guy, Jalen Smith, who's right. like a freak of nature.
Yeah, what do you think Kevin Cross was thinking? By the
way? I know. Like, Kevin's like, probably like, oh, yikes. This is,
looking
yeah,
up like,
right. So sure. I think that this is it's an interesting case study. But I also think, again, one, I think you can't quite treat it as a win, but you can almost. Like, I think that this is something where they didn't win, but it's
weird
you
because
feel
like,
so much better afterwards.
Yeah, and
you know what
I don't
mean?
Know how the players feel exactly, and you know we probably won't know it until maybe a couple months out of the season. But like when I'm looking at Nebraska, I'm not looking at wins and losses. I haven't been
right.
looking at wins and losses since, you know, the Big East or Big Ten play restarted. Mm. Like as soon as it was January, it's like, well, it's not about wins and losses for this team. It's like what tangible elements of progress can you find that'll be applicable next year
yeah.
or 2 years? And so that's what this game was for
yeah.
me is like, oh man, that like everything that you're saying about what Nebraska could be without necessarily a true center, but with the way that it runs its offense and the way that it can scrap and fight defensively, it could work.
Yeah, yeah. It was a again, and it was a.
You obviously got to do it more consistently. You
sure.
Can't,
yeah.
Can't lose
totally.
By 40 to or be down by 40 to Iowa and then, you know,
come back. Yeah, it's a roller coaster. Right. Like this whole season's been a total roller coaster. And so it's interesting to me because I wonder too, you know, I've talked about how I think the college basketball season is like some phases and you've got, you know, beginning and then you've got, you know, the beginning, you have the beginning of the season, like the non-conference, it doesn't really matter. And then you have, you know, kind of the tournament phase, and then you have the beginning of the Big Ten play phase, and then you have the grind. And what we're about to hit is the final push, right? We're about to hit, you know, early March, you know, late February, early March, where it's the final push, and you've got a couple more games left. And so I'm curious if this Maryland game is a sign of, all right, there's a couple wins coming, or there's a couple games coming. So, like, they've got Wisconsin, and I don't think Wisconsin's all that great. Wisconsin beat Nebraska because they made a school record three-pointers.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're going, Nebraska's going to have to change the defense a little bit. I would be floored if Wisconsin had the same type of shooting night, especially inside PBA, where teams, it takes a minute to kind of get used to that arena, I think.
Well, teams just haven't shot it great.
And teams haven't shot it great there. You're right.
Most teams haven't.
Yeah.
Or if you look at the splits, it's like, well, Purdue's kind of. Actually, most teams in the Big Ten are like this, where they go on the road, they just don't shoot as well.
Right. Exactly. So there's no way they're going to shoot as well. Yeah. You do have Michigan State after that, and that's going to be tough. You have Illinois, but you've got some injuries with Illinois now.
Yeah,
so
we'll
kind of see what's going on there. But that is on the road. Yeah. You have a weird Ohio State team coming to Lincoln that, beyond me, what's going on there. A Northwestern game that is winnable because Northwestern isn't any good. And then you finish with Michigan and Minnesota. Now, Michigan, I believe, is just ahead of Nebraska still. Nope, Indiana. So Michigan jumped ahead a little bit.
Michigan got Livers back. That's big.
Yes, it's huge. So that's going to be hard.
Maybe the Wolverines make that push.
And that is on the road, so that's going to be hard. But then there's Minnesota that's also on the road, and Minnesota is kind of hit or miss. If you can shake some loose, if you can have a good night, like I think if Nebraska played as hard as they did against Maryland and they shot a little bit better, they could beat Wisconsin. They could beat Northwestern. They could beat Minnesota. Right now, you know, we're not going to talk as much like Big Ten race because Nebraska's definitely not going to win the Big Ten. but right now, as it stands, they're 13th, and in Indianapolis, they would play Indiana first round.
Yeah.
And Indiana is a train wreck. Archie Miller is sweating.
Do you feel like
profusely?
Something's up. It is. Indiana feels a little off, but also it could just be the Big Ten. I mean, you look at
some of these teams
that like Michigan hit a skid. If you have like one little flaw, all of a sudden it becomes a huge issue.
Sure.
And then you lose like three or four in a row. Like, how many teams have lost a lot or just had bad skids in this league? Because
it's like climbing a mountain. You cannot like step on that mossy log. Like you have to stay on the course. And I think Indiana in particular, I think they have the wrong head coach for that program.
But everyone loves Archie.
Sure. Yeah. That's why they brought Bobby Knight back, so that they could distract people from the fact that their team isn't very good.
It didn't work out very nicely.
Nobody was talking about the fact that Indiana lost at home to Purdue. Nobody. Everyone was talking about Bob Knight.
Except for Purdue fans.
But Indiana fans left that game being like, well, that was cool, but also, what the hell?
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is, at this moment, Nebraska would play Indiana in Indianapolis, a weird Indiana team. And so maybe they steal one there. Like, I think that at the beginning of Big Ten play, we talked about, you know, how many legitimate games could Nebraska actually win in the Big Ten. And I think that we said three.
Yeah.
Right?
We did.
They're currently at two.
Right.
I think they could definitely win one. I think they could definitely win another one.
They could win a couple.
We'll see.
I think that's probably all we got.
Yeah.
We'll be back again shortly to talk more hoops.
Yeah.
This is the best time of year, I think. Maybe March.
We're about to be the best time of the year. It's close. It's like we're still inching toward. But like, especially now is the time when you start looking at, now is when you can start to actually take, you know, NCAA tournament seedings a little bit seriously.
Yeah, a little more serious. The committee came out with its top 16.
Yeah.
So
you can start to look at stuff. And it's also, especially if you're, you know, you live in Omaha or you live in the Nebraska area, now it's starting to be like, oh, hey, like, you know, they're coming soon.
Right.
First and second round.
I think
it's
pretty
Omaha.
clear that Kansas is coming here, and it might be like Baylor comes here too.
Boy,
so if we get 2-1 seeds, or if Baylor slips to two, or KU slips to two, I don't know how it's going to shake out. That could be a lot of fun, because like I feel like the
Baylor could
8-9 game, and or the 2-7-10 game, whatever that second round game is, there's a potential for upsets. And
so it would be so theoretically it could be Kansas is Midwest, they go to Omaha, Baylor is the South, and they go wherever South is. Well, Gonzaga gets the first West, round, and South Dakota State, or excuse me, San Diego State gets
the East. They've talked. That's how the committee laid it out.
Huh.
San Diego State got shipped to the East, but the first and second rounds, they'll send you wherever. It's just like whatever's closest. So I don't know. I've seen Baylor in certain spots push to Omaha. I've also seen like Iowa here as like a three seed or a four seed.
Yeah.
I think I saw someone.
Tom is the one that wants that.
Did Tom draw up Iowa, Northern Iowa in the first round? Like that would be,
that'd be delicious.
Amazing.
I love that the NCAA, like the tournament selection committee, they're like, oh, well, we don't care about narratives in the tournament. We don't do it, which is like total crap. But I would be surprised, though. I think if KU is a one seed, they're coming here. I would be surprised if they brought Baylor here instead.
Well,
that would be a bummer for everybody.
KU's
because
coming here for sure,
Baylor
no doubt.
Is,
but Baylor could come as well. That's my thing. It's like,
yeah,
they could maybe they find a way to make them both come here. But
they've lost once. But boy, I watched them the other night, and I wanted to like I was on a treadmill, and I wanted to like fall onto the treadmill, and it would have been more fun getting like rolling my ankle.
Did they
watching.
Still have
oh,
they
gosh,
still have
horrible.
KU twice? Is that how
they,
this schedule works out?
Yep, they get so they have they finish with they get West Virginia, Oklahoma. They have to play KU, and then they end with West Virginia. They have to play West Virginia twice in the next couple weeks, but they do play KU, but it's in Waco. I mean, remember Baylor beat KU in Lawrence. Weird KU team too.
So they only have KU once, but they have
West they played Virginia. KU twice. They have them one more time.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, one more time, and then but West Virginia twice. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see.
All right. If Creighton and Nebraska play today, who you got?
I mean, I'd have Creighton for sure. are we talking Penn State energy or Maryland energy?
Maryland energy. Nebraska at its best. Like if the two teams played
at Baxter,
like the way they played the last couple, last
Creighton by 15.
Yeah, I'd say that's
but it's a 15 where it's like it's closer.
It's actually yeah,
and not because again, I was thinking about this. It's weird. You know, remember how much Creighton beat Nebraska by?
19.
Yeah, but it felt like what 40?
Yeah.
You know, it was just a weird. So I think it'd be 15, but it felt like 10.
Right. All right, we'll be back again next week. Talk some hoops. Thanks for listening.